Podcast, a podcast where we talk about Harrison Ford and his movies and all that great stuff.
And I'm Lauren Milberger.
And I'm Rachel Leishman.
And we are your hosts of sorts.
Yeah, I think that's what we're called.
So today's Blade Runner.
Yes, today we're talking about Blade Runner, the 1982 Ridley Scott classic.
Now, I think we've talked before that I don't really have any personal stories because I just saw it for the first time in May. But do you have any personal stories on Blade Runner?
I mean, I saw it when I was younger but didn't really remember it, and then rewatched it and just my name is in it. That's about what I got.
Rachel.
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 Rachel. But spelled differently.
Yeah,
so,
Rachel,
you know,
is how it's spelled. It doesn't make any fucking sense.
Well, it's like Deborah and Deborah. They both say Deborah. They're just spelled differently.
Rachel makes more sense than Rachel.
That's
Rachel.
True.
Ay, ay, ay.
Maybe it's in the book some foreign name. Like,
no,
it comes from another country.
I don't know. It's dumb.
It doesn't matter. So something that I would love to talk about before we go into the Blade Runner is where the Blade Runner, like it's the Titanic.
Yeah.
Where Harrison was in his career, because I think it's actually really interesting, the change that he went through after Raiders of the Lost Ark, because he became much more successful. And it was something that Peter Mayhew actually experienced, was after Raiders, I don't believe it had come out yet, but he was in LA and he and his wife had dinner with Harrison. And he said that it was like a complete change, that he was a completely different person. And when he first met him, he was very much like Han Solo. He was cocky and edgy and sort of reckless. And he had mellowed, and he said he felt that he was contented and it showed. He was less tortured and more a calmer person. And some might say it could be the example of his girlfriend at the time, Melissa, who eventually became his wife. But I think also it's to do with the fact that he was finally at a point where he creatively, he was able to be the person he wanted to be. He's able to have the career that he wanted to be, and as a creative artist to have the life that he had sort of always wanted to. And I just think that's sort of interesting from an artist's point of view. Also to the effect of, he said that he also built more confidence that he saw over the years, which I thought was really interesting. As he said, Harrison is Harrison. He can put up with things that other actors can't, which is also something that shows to his character. Having a sense of humor after 3 or 4 hours out in the cold, he's referring to when they were filming for Empire. He's a true professional. When I first met him, he did things fair and squarely the way he thought. But if a director thought differently, then fine. In Star Wars, he was fairly confident, but then in Empire, that confidence grew. And we've been talking about, at least I have, that I think that that confidence grew because he finally had directors who were listening to him.
Mm-hmm.
So he's growing as an artist because he can ask the questions he wants to answer. And in turn, I think also becoming a little bit calmer. So it's interesting how they're sort of feeding together, that you have sometimes actors can be sort of this sort of, I mean, maybe you don't have that experience, but like the young actors, you know, oh, I know everything, I can do this. And he even talks about that he, in his youthful ignorance, my need to not be dominated was greater than my sense of responsibility. So I feel like the two things kind of came together at the right time, and he became the artist he wanted to be, and then his temperament seemed to soften. Because when I read about him at the beginning, I didn't recognize him. I was like, the things I'm reading about Harrison Ford, this doesn't seem like the person I know. Maybe he's not such a great guy, but I feel like he grew into that now at the point in his career that we're getting to.
Yeah.
So I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, definitely.
If you have anything to add, go right ahead.
No, I mean, I feel like he went from being this guy who wasn't getting what he wanted to someone who now was getting what he wanted and had the career he kind of wanted, and it was starting to make him a happier person.
Yeah, so there's something to be said all about that, is that, you know, when you're content in your life, you could be better in your career.
Yeah.
So something I just wanted to do some business from last week. Someone online, 2 weeks ago, I always say that, who made a point that I accidentally said that Secret of the Incas was a serial, and I didn't mean to say that. I meant to say that it was a film, along with Greatest Show on Earth, which had similar outfits that were definitely based on Indiana Jones. And we actually have pictures of Charlton Heston, who was in both movies, wearing very similar outfits on our Instagram if you want to check it out. So I'm sorry about that. And also, just to warn people that we do talk about spoilers on the show, and we try as much as possible to give warnings, but we put it in the summary. So if you're concerned about something, you know, read the summary beforehand so you don't get spoiled. And odds are we will always be talking about Star Wars in some sense, and that means all of them. So that's a little warning.
Did someone get mad?
Someone got mad.
Han Solo dies. It's old knowledge.
This person didn't know, so I'm just saying that we put it in the summary. The spoilers that we're talking about.
I want you to message me because I just want to know, because I'm very interested right now, how you'll go through a podcast that is about Harrison Ford, but, like, have not seen the most recent of the Harrison Ford.
There were a lot of people that I was surprised that hadn't seen it. I guess you could be a casual Harrison Ford fan.
Okay, but then why would you...
I know. I don't understand. There could be, you know, a myriad of reasons why you're unable to get to the theater.
Dumbledore dies.
Rosebud is the sled.
John Harrison is Khan.
I see dead people.
Spock isn't dead. What else do we want? Like, lost, they're all in purgatory. Like, what other pop culture things that are, like, wildly known?
Darth Vader is Luke's father.
That, spoilers. I'm not being mean. I'm just very interested.
We're riffing. We're bantering.
I'm just, like, very interested. We've spoiled it multiple times, so it's like you saw that episode.
Or
you
listened to just that episode. I felt so bad. It was someone who was listening out of order, and I was like, well, I put in the summary, but, you know, everyone has a different love of Harrison Ford. All we care about is that they're listening.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Yeah, no, yeah. Agreed. Just, it's baffling.
So should we move on to a short little segment, which we teased jokingly that we would do many, many episodes ago, which is...
Spoiler alert, E.T. goes home.
Is talk about E.T.
Oh, boy.
So it's Aliens and Replicants. This episode is Aliens and Replicants.
LOL, Ridley Scott. Get it?
He made
Alien? Okay.
I did. I got it.
Oh, boy.
No, you're really good. I got it. Many people may not know this or know this, that E.T. was written by...
Melissa Matheson.
Yes, I almost called him Han Solo.
I know.
Harrison Ford's second wife, Melissa. Harrison actually took his girlfriend at the time, Melissa, on set with him for Raiders. She got dysentery. She was there many, many times with them. And that's where she met Steven Spielberg. And they really got along, and she had sort of given up on writing, which I think is another great sort of story, just like Harrison's, of like, it didn't seem like it was working out. Maybe this isn't for me. And then, it, you know, dreams happen and it works out. So they sort of became, you know, friendly, and he asked her if she might like to write this movie that he had an idea about. And she said no. She's very shy, apparently. And Harrison was like, you need to do this. And apparently the kids are based on Harrison's children. Other kids as well, but, you know, those were the kids that were in her life, even down to the PJs. And then Harrison was asked to be in the film, which many people may or may not know.
I know that because of Connor Ratliff.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the best improv move I've ever seen in a scene, where they were all being characters from E.T., and someone walked in as Elliot, someone walked in as Drew Barrymore, so everyone assumed he was going to come in as E.T., and he said, I'm Harrison Ford, who played the principal in a deleted scene in E.T. And I busted out laughing, and everyone in that scene looked at him and went, what? And he had to explain himself again, and the audience was like, some people were laughing, but some people were like, what is happening? And I, like, could not quit laughing. I thought it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. And to this day, I still think it's the best move I've ever seen.
And you just saw the scene, like, a second
ago. For the first time,
because I assumed you'd seen it, but it was just that
Connor Ratliff pointed out Ford was in a deleted scene.
Well, Melissa's in the scene. She plays a nurse, and she was terrified, and one of the big reasons that they did cut it, or at least she begged it to be cut, is because her camera shyness is really obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't really notice that because I was mostly focused on Harrison's performance, which I don't think is that good.
Granted, you can't judge it because he's not in... You can't see him.
He's in shadow. They probably didn't want, you know, his famous face to take away from it. He was shot a lot from the back. There's a lot of Venetian blinds. But he's putting on this voice, this character. And I think we've talked about in the past, like, he's better when he just does his natural voice, when he...
I mean, I liked it. I thought it was fine. I just didn't need to be an E.T., and that's why I was like, all right. It was unnecessary, but I think it was fine.
I bet he just wanted to also support his girlfriend at the time. And I don't know who was asked to be in the scene first, if it was her or him, but she was terrified because she's not an actor. She was a writer. But yeah, so if you want to check it out, it's on YouTube, if anyone wants to watch it. What's also interesting is that he filmed this after Blade Runner because he had taken a 6-month break to be with his kids. And he said that only an act of Congress would stop him from taking that break. But I think also he was so exhausted from Blade Runner emotionally and physically that he needed that break.
And he took it and was in E.T.
Yeah, because people may not realize, but he was actually home to film this in the last, you know, few movies. He was literally in the same dressing room in the studios in London. Like, he wasn't able to be at home in the United States in town to be with his kids.
Interesting. Interessant.
So the original name of this movie was called Dangerous Days. We may or may not know it's based on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? By Philip K. Dick. And it has a sort of a really interesting history. They Ridley wanted to call it Gotham City, but Bob Kane said no. The only reason that Harrison Ford and not Dustin Hoffman has the role is because Barbara Hershey was friends with Hampton, the writer, and she had been talking to Steven Spielberg on the phone while he was filming Raiders, and he said that Harrison was going to be the world's greatest box office sensation.
And he is!
End quote. So he was, yeah. But Dustin Hoffman, they wanted to kind of go a little different, but he wanted so many changes, and they felt it was going to be too political and social. But I thought what was really funny was apparently they all flew to London, they watched some rushes of Raiders, were very impressed, met with Harrison after he was done filming, and they claimed that he was still wearing the jacket and the hat, which seems odd for Harrison. I guess he just didn't change. So they saw the hat, and they were very upset because they wanted Rick to wear a similar hat, and then they were forced to not use this hat. So then they decided to do a haircut, which Ridley wasn't too excited about, and it literally took 2 hours because he had to sit there and do a director's cut of his haircut.
Oh, boy.
But everyone else was sort of cast on, and we're going to talk about that when we have our interview or our real panel discussion with Jay Holtham. No really familiar faces. And again, it's another movie where the people behind the scenes compare him to Bogey. And Errol Flynn, actually. So this keeps coming up.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else that you want to add about... Oh, Harrison also, which we'll talk about too, he really felt ignored as an actor, and that the relationship between him and Rachel was not as explored as much as he would have liked.
Well, yeah, it wasn't, but...
Yeah. Sean Young was cast because she looked a lot like Vivian Leigh, according to...
Ridley Scott.
Yeah, and there's the great famous scene, Tears in the Rain. That section was improvised by Rutger Hauer. Oh, and Joanna Cassidy had her own snake.
And it's terrifying.
As you do. You just have your own snake.
You have a snake.
Yeah. So now I guess we'll go into
our interview with Jay Holtham. Holtham?
Yeah.
Hotham?
Holtham.
Holtham.
Take it away.
Rachel?
So we're now going on to the discussion part of the Fordcast, and we have a special guest. Special guest, please introduce yourself.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jay Holtham. I'm a writer, an ex-playwright, and semi-professional geek. I have a podcast, Deep Cut Nerd, and I'm a regular guest on another podcast, Part-Time Fanboy. And I'm also a writer on a new show on Fox called Pitch, which is not genre-related, but it is sort of... alternate university in some alternate.
But I also think that it's something that a lot of our listeners would be interested in. Tell us a little bit about it. We're both really excited about seeing it.
Sure. It's a new drama this fall about a woman who becomes a pitcher for the San Diego Padres, a young black woman, first woman pitcher in the major leagues, and it deals with her issues as a pitcher, as a woman, dealing with Major League Baseball, sexism, being a role model. and all of that fun stuff.
Awesome. And I believe from all the Subway posters, it's September 22nd on Fox?
September 22nd, yep. Just under a month from this recording date.
Oh, yay.
Yes, yes, very, very
all right,
exciting.
So we usually like to start the podcast by talking about personal stories or relationships mm-hmm. with Blade Runner. And one of the big reasons I wanted you on is that you are a big, much bigger fan of Blade Runner than we are, even though we both really appreciate the film. So well, what is your personal connection to Blade Runner?
My personal connection, I was trying to think about the very first time I saw it. And it's hard. It's like a favorite song. At this point, I've seen virtually every version, most of them in the theater. I'm pretty sure I saw it in the theater when I was about 8 or so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because my dad, his theory on children and movies was since he had to sit through it, it had to be a movie that he would want to sit through, and he refused to see any children's movies, so I didn't see any cartoons. I saw movies like Escape from New York and Blade Runner.
As well, a you child. Pretty much had the same upbringing as Aaron Sorkin, so hey.
Yay!
Good writers, yeah.
That worked out well for me. So... So I mean, it's one of those, you know, it's a foundational movie in science fiction, filmmaking and science fiction storytelling. It's always been an important movie to me, which is why I've now seen at least 4 different cuts, of the like 12 that are out there.
So are there really 12 though?
No.
I found 6.
No, there are about 6.
There's 6? Okay.
I think 6 is about right. And seeing every couple of years, Ridley Scott does another version of it.
including He's worse than George Lucas.
He is so much worse than George Lucas. It's one of those things where it's like, is there going to be a voiceover or some voiceover, no voiceover? How much are we going to walk away from this thinking Deckard's a replicant? How little? It's all these very slight tweaks.
He's not. Well, I don't know. I mean, they don't age. He can't be a replicant if he's old. It doesn't work.
I agree with you, but they could come up with anything.
It's, exactly.
You know, he's a robot. They could just say, he was a better model than it's the other ones.
Exactly.
And he could,
that's the whole point about Rachel. Rachel's a replicant who doesn't know she's a replicant, which is an advancement. And we don't know that Deckard, and how do we know that Deckard ages? Come on.
Because Harrison Ford
he's
is playing
old.
Him. That's the problem,
Harrison Ford is old.
But should we go into sort of that first then, since we're sort of talking about it, kind of the big age-old question and what that means?
That is.
Is he a replicant or is he not a replicant?
Right.
What are your thoughts?
I've always leaned to that he's not, to be honest. I don't think that he is.
We both agree.
Story doesn't makes less sense if he is. I think Harrison Ford prefers to think that he is, which is weird.
He does, which is interesting because everybody is on Harrison's side except for Ridley Scott. Everyone is like, it ruins the story if he is not human because it's a story about a man discovering his humanness by chasing these non-human. You know, would you agree, Rachel?
Yeah. Like it's. The story of a man who's kind of been like grizzled down by what his job entailed, and it's him then returning to that job and tracking down these replicants and remembering what makes him a human compared to like, because he falls in love with one of these replicants and he realizes like, oh shit, this is what makes a human tick, that she's not recognizing the things that I am. So if he's a replicant, it completely diminishes any of that realization.
Yeah.
And what I thought was also interesting too was Harrison Ford said that his also big issue is that he wanted the audience to have a surrogate, to have a representation, someone to follow through the story, which you need in a story. You need someone that you go, that's the me, that's the person I'm going to follow with.
Right.
And every time on set, when he thought that he was being, you know, geared toward or positioned to be a replicant, he would have odds with Ridley and they would, you know, have
Ridley.
An issue about it because he didn't want that.
Right.
What did I say?
Wrigley. You keep saying Wrigley. It's Ridley.
It's now becoming a thing on the show where I just mispronounce everyone's names wrong.
Ridley
Scott. Oh,
it is
he's
Ridley
fine.
Scott.
Ridley's fine. He gets it. I mean, the other problem.
He's like, yeah, I'm a famous field in Chicago.
or bubblegum. Ridley.
Either way, it's one or
Ridley
the other.
Scott.
Other problem though with Deckard being a replicant is that it undercuts like the essential tragedy of the thing, which is the tragedy of Roy Batty and the question of can the replicants become human? Like, you would have to have a human who is more robotic, who is like killed off all of his humanness, to contrast with a replicant who has become incredibly human and incredibly, you know, beautiful and soulful.
He saves his life. So here is a replicant who is unhuman, who then portrays a human quality by saving a human. Mm-hmm. If he saves a fellow replicant, because right. the assumption is it, on the camp, I believe, and I could be wrong, people who believe he's a replicant believe that Roy Batty sees that and you know, knows. So then what's the whole point of him saving him?
It completely diminishes it.
He's just saving like his own kind.
It's a replicant with a replicant rather than a replicant going and saving the people who are trying to destroy him.
Yeah. I almost wonder, though, even – I mean, obviously things change, and Harrison knew on set what was happening and did not like it.
Right.
But I was sort of wondering if maybe it's about keeping up the mystery of it. That part of the movie is, well, is he or isn't he? Like the ambiguity. And I kind of actually do like that, that like maybe you don't know if he is. So I kind of was wondering if maybe this is just something that Ridley Scott is playing on us all.
I mean, maybe. And if he is, there is... I don't know. There's something to that, but I get a little annoyed at that kind of cutesy stuff. Like, tell us the answer.
I agree, but...
Just give us enough clues. Like, Inception, there are enough clues that say he's in the real world at the end. You just have to watch carefully. I'm like, that's fine. I am okay with that.
That is so funny, because this is the second time in two podcasts that I've had this conversation, and we've brought up Inception, because we've watched Drive.
Oh.
And we were talking about how, like, at the end of Drive, it's like he's really hurt and you don't know if he lived. Like, you don't know. Like, the ambiguity of it. It's like, well, no, it's geared towards us being like, no, he's just a monster who drives off and is fine and alive.
Right.
And I kept thinking about that when we were talking, because I kind of want that to be the character that Ryan Gosling plays in the sequel. Because he's such a monster and so robot-like and has no emotions other than these certain scenes. That I think it's such a contrast to have a character like that compared to these replicants who are not seen as human beings.
Right, exactly. Like, you,
so I kind of want that.
You totally want that. Like, come on. Or if Harrison Ford's going to be in it, he shouldn't play Deckard. Like, he should play someone else or something, or, you know, whatever. The original, I'd love to, like, get into the idea of who are the replicants based on, if anyone. Are they clones? Are they robots? It's totally unclear.
That would be a cool story if it was, like, what are the clones based on? And then you find out that Deckard is a replicant because he was replicated after the younger version this guy. And then it's Harrison
Ford. That's interesting, because I read the cliff notes of the book on Wiki just to sort of get a sense. And in the book, Rachel is the same model as Pris.
Oh.
So he has to warn her. She has to warn him that when you go after Pris, she's going to look like me.
Oh,
so
wow.
So it's not like he just has to kill something that he considers, you know, human-like.
Right.
Is he has to then kill someone who looks like the woman that he's fallen in love with.
Ooh, that's wild.
So they just didn't do that in the movie.
They didn't. Well, the movie is very, from what I've really read, very loosely based on the book.
It's what happens to all of Philip K. Dick's books. They are these great ideas that get turned into movies that have, like, no relationship to the book. At all. Like, there's no direct... Do androids dream of electric sheep? I read it when I was, like, 14, which was way too young to read it, because I don't know that I understood a word of what I was reading. It is a crazy-ass book.
It sounds really heavy.
Yeah, yeah. It's much more deep and much more philosophical than the movie is. And this movie is pretty deep and philosophical for that, but, like, the book's intense.
He doesn't save her. Oh, I forget. Does she get killed or she dies?
Rachel or Pris?
Rachel.
No, Rachel and him.
No, in the book. In the book.
Oh, I was like what are you talking about?
Like, it's interesting that the movie's even without the happy ending of them going off into the sunset and being happy together for 4 years, I guess. It definitely adds more of, I think, a supposed romantic element in the movie, making it very Hollywood as opposed to the book.
Romantic. He straight up like raped her.
Well, and let's then talk about
it's
that.
Like, oh, romantic.
And again, but that's 80s movies romance. That's how 80s movies were.
Hold on, it's not romantic.
I was trying to put a lilt in my voice, and then let's talk about that. So, this is, if you're unaware, I don't know if we talked about this, Jay, but I had never seen Blade Runner until about 2 months ago. So I did not know about this scene. I thought that it was a romance between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was not expecting this at all. And it definitely felt like a rape scene to me.
Right.
Now, I know that some people don't agree.
Right.
But,
Or are they white men?
I don't know. They could
probably.
Be.
Probably.
Yeah, anyone at this point would be a white
man. By surprise. Now, I know originally it was meant to be a little more romantic,
yeah.
But Sean Young and Harrison Ford did not get along.
Cool, so it makes me not like Harrison Ford. not the character. It makes me just like him.
But here's the thing. Yeah. This is something I want to bring up. We'll go back to the relationship, but about Harrison Ford, because mm-hmm. it's become quite famous, as we're alluding to, that he did not get along with Sean Young.
Mm-hmm.
She has attested that it was sexism, that right. there's also the fact that Sean Young was not as experienced, and
right.
Harrison Ford is a consummate professional, which
right.
everyone kept saying. He was very wary when she was cast, but when she was cast, he was like, that was it. There are stories of him and Joanna Cassidy where he's lovely to her. He mm-hmm. was... When she was doing those stunts, he was always checking in with her because Harrison does stunts on set. In fact, he got stunt pay for this movie because he was doing so much, which eventually we will find out was a detriment to his own health. So he shouldn't have. But he's so concerned about her and like checking in and being like, are you cool with this? Like, you can tell them if you don't want to do this. And she felt that he was just lovely and appreciated that he was, as a fellow actor
mm-hmm.
and a fellow and as a woman, he treated her lovely. So I don't think that it's a detriment to Harrison Ford as a person. I
yeah.
think that sometimes you don't get along with everybody, and many people have also brought up that perhaps Sean Young may not have been as much of an experienced actor at the time, so she was using what she was feeling, which was
yeah.
she did not feel a connection to this man.
Oh, I'm not saying bad on him. I'm just saying that if that scene was supposed to be romantic and turn into rapey because he didn't like a girl, it kind of makes it a little like, okay, that's a little pushing it. Like,
right.
You are an actor. Like, you can pretend to like a human.
Yeah.
If
you
don't.
Can.
Like,
you can. But I said it jokingly, but I will say this about the 1980s and filmmaking, and even though it's only 30 years away from it, I had not thought until recently that scene was at all rapey. Like, it was just, this is how, like, there's usually one of those sex scenes in those, in 1980s.
Yeah, and the way the music was, that's
yeah.
the thing, too, is that I feel like it's a retrospect thing as well
yeah.
for a lot of
yeah.
people, because the... And again, why I say romantic, and I tried to say it with a lilt or with air quotes, which no one can see, is that they're playing what typically in the 80s would be romantic type
exactly.
music.
Yeah.
It's very
yeah.
unnerving.
Well, I guess it goes back to also like my favorite thing about like old timey movie kisses are that it looks like neither party enjoys them.
What?
Like, it's like literally like, what?
No, exactly that. Then like,
yeah,
nobody,
yeah, like it looks
just
like they're,
mashing.
They're upset. Yeah, they're like upset that they have to do this. And, like, my favorite movie of all time is Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Mm-hmm.
But even that final kiss that's, like, so beautiful, it's, like, she looks like she's in pain. And I love Audrey. Audrey's my hero. But I'm also like, Audrey, come on.
Right.
Like, you... Like, as an actor, I'm sitting there like, Audrey, enjoy it a little bit. Like, you are clear... You look like you are hating every moment of this. And I do understand, like, yeah, the 80s was, like... There's the man being like, I'm going to put you in your place was like attractive.
Right.
But still, like, that scene just made me so uncomfortable.
Very
especially
uncomfortable.
When he like pushes her at one point. I'm like, cool, now.
For me, it's not attractive. For me, it's when he blocks the door.
Yeah, that too. Like,
he blocks
like,
the door. She wants to leave and he blocks it and then makes her say all those things. But here's something interesting. Now, have you guys seen the full edit of that scene?
No. I didn't revisit that scene. I watched
okay.
it and said, cool.
I found it on YouTube. I believe it's on the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
It was much more sexier. There's nudity in it, for one thing, which is not what I'm getting at. But there's a particular shot. There's actually a bunch of different versions. But the first one I saw had a shot where he lifts his hands up. He lifts her skirt up. He touches her. And she makes a sound as if she's enjoying that.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, even though the scene is uncomfortable, if they had just left in that part of it,
right.
I might have thought, okay, she's inexperienced. She's into it now. She's right. being touched and going, oh, I like this. This is not scary anymore. Right. And therefore agreeing to it. I don't
know. They need to have one moment where she's like, cool, yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. Just yeah. get that. And I'm like, this is no longer rapey. Just have her say, yeah, cool. You're a little aggressive, but I'm okay with it. And then it would have been like, great, not rapey anymore. But they didn't give me that. They were just like,
no, they didn't.
But it's just interesting to me how that little section was cut out, which is mm-hmm. a woman having some sort of pleasure, but mostly I think it was because of the rating. I think they wanted to give it a better rating.
No, Ridley Scott is known for being sexist. Like, it's like a wildly known. He gave us great female characters.
I like to play devil's advocate. I like to play devil's advocate and give someone, you know, a
you
chance
to give the benefit of the doubt. I appreciate that. I appreciate that, but I mean, it's. I think that it's probably six or one half dozen of the other that, like, yeah, at the time, ratings-wise, that, and this is just also the stupidity of our culture, that probably would have pushed it, like, closer to, like, NC-7, not even NC-17, yeah. then it would have been X.
It wasn't that bad. He's touching her breasts, so you can only really see sort of the side of it. But still, the first cut that I saw was just the hands up the legs. Right. But this is actually before PG-13.
Right, yeah. So it was either, PG or R.
And originally they were going towards PG, and Philip K. Dick was not very happy with that. He was like, I really wish you guys would go towards an R. And they were like, no, we've decided to shoot towards PG.
So is it PG?
I didn't check. I believe it is.
Blade Runner is a PG movie?
This is why in a future episode we'll talk about why PG-13 had to be a thing. Oh, no, it's R. Never mind. It's definitely
R. It's R. Yeah, it's definitely R.
Never mind. I don't know what
Because, Joanna Cassidy is naked in it. Like, she's a stripper.
Ratings are different. Maybe it would have been an X.
Listen.
It could have got to X. Like, and that's the because, there was no NC-17 either.
All right, I guess it's a different time period. Yeah. I was just going to say, what did Necrophilia or whatever that stupid Shia LaBeouf movie get?
Speaking of, can I just add something that I thought was hilarious was Rucker Hauer.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you say his name, right? Right.
Yep.
He was just talking about how he feels that the replicants have more of a story and that Deckard is actually really boring and not that interesting.
Yeah.
And he summed up his story was he kills people in cold blood and then fucks a I'm gonna mess it up and then fucks a dishwasher.
Wow, Rucker Hauer, you're just breaking it right down. Yeah. That's all right. There you go. That's all right. Ooh.
To go back to that scene.
Yes.
It made me not uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
It made me uncomfortable. But it made me soups uncomfortable because it was my name. So it's any time he was being, like, weirdly aggressive, I was like, okay, I do not like this. And I was like, and I can separate the fact that my name is just this character's name as well, but I don't like that it's like, Rachel. I'm like, what? I didn't do anything. I'm sitting on my couch watching this fucking movie.
Now, what do you think? I don't agree with this, but many people will say, oh, well, that just shows that he's an anti-hero.
No!
Right.
It's rapey moment!
There's something different about raping a woman who's unwilling as opposed to going after these people who are dangerous.
Yeah.
That is just a little bit on the line for me.
It's a little bit over the line, and it's a little bit, like, lazy. I mean, granted, we're talking about one of the first movies to do that, sort of in context, that, like, Deckard becomes a kind of stereotype. And model for science fiction anti-heroes to come, but at this point it's pretty lazy to be like, oh, he rapes a woman, he's a bad guy, and you're like,
it gave us things like Loki, and like it opened the gateway to these characters that we now are like, oh my god, this poor, like, that's to me, that's why everyone like feels bad for Kylo Ren. I'm like, why? He's a piece of shit. Like, why do you feel bad for Kylo Ren? And it was a great thing, but also, like, a horrible detriment to everyone's psyche. Because people are, like, saying, oh, no, he's just misunderstood. I'm like, no, he straight up raped a woman. This swimmer should be in jail, not back at Stanford. This guy, and I was like, it's, like, leading into our real world. Because people are like, well, I love Deckard. And I'm like, cool, Deckard's great, but you also need to separate. We just talked about this on another podcast, but you need to separate the film from your reality.
Exactly, And you need to separate what you're supposed to feel about them. Like, anyone who says, it's like people who watch House of Cards and are like, ooh, I want a marriage, like the Underwoods have. I'm like, what's wrong with you?
What?
What is wrong with you?
It's all over the place.
Claire Underwood is not a model of female empowerment. No, nope. Those are terrible, terrible people. And we're supposed to walk away from thinking those are terrible people.
That's interesting. You know, I listened to Anna Faris's podcast. Mm-hmm. She talked about her character from Lost in Translation.
And then she said
someone come up to her and be like, I loved that character. I so related to her. And she was like, oh my God. That's not good.
Seek help. Well, I'm the villain.
I know everyone sees what they want to see. That's true.
But I also think we've become a world of, like, we lead ourselves into letting these characters kind of change our perceptions of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, my big thing about, okay, for instance, on the internet right now, what's driving me crazy are people who go on and on and on and on about how James T. Kirk is not a womanizer. And I'm like, okay, cool. You aren't watching Star Trek.
Yeah,
he's not a womanizer. He just loves women, and he will sleep with any one of them because he loves them. He's not, he doesn't use and abuse them. He just loves them. And I agree. Like, I'm like, yeah, okay. It is true. He's always in, like, if you watch any Star Trek episode, he's in love with the person he's sleeping with. And then the next episode, he has a different girl. But people want, like, they're like, Star Trek Beyond did it. I love Star Trek Beyond. I think it did a great job, but they're like, it did a great job because it didn't make Kirk,
right, he didn't.
Yeah, it did make womanizing, and I was like, here's the, but like, Simon Pegg was like, well, he's pansexual. I'm like, that's great, because Kirk just loves people. Kirk is like, I would sleep with anything.
Sure.
But the internet is trying to be like, no, he's not that way. I'm like, you're changing the character of Kirk to appease you. Like,
exactly.
That's not how it works.
Exactly.
Well, that happens also. You know, people will put their own thoughts and their own personalities on characters that they love.
Right.
And go, oh, that character would make that decision.
Right.
Well, no, because you're seeing them through your filter, and you're because they mean something to you in a very personal way, you may be clouded. And some people, you know, will think certain things that happen in The Force Awakens made sense to character, and other people who feel that it was character assassination. And
right.
It's the same character we're all seeing.
Right.
Is and add in childhood and nostalgia, but we superimpose that, I think, on
exactly.
top of people.
We
so
do.
Blade and Runner means a lot to you.
Yeah, and in a way, speaking, you know, to like Harrison Ford and to your whole podcast, we also, in some ways, kind of ascribe character traits to the actor, to the performer. And
yeah,
we think, you know, Harrison Ford wouldn't be mean to poor little Sean Young. I'm like, he's an actor, so he's playing a character, and that character would. And we're supposed to feel bad about that. We're supposed to feel conflicted, and it's okay to say, you know, I have a conflicted reaction to this thing. We don't have to just love them unconditionally because we do. Like, yeah, it's totally. And Blade Runner is a weird, dark, in many ways ugly movie. And like, Rutger Hauer has a point. Roy Batty is in some ways the hero and is the best person in this movie. Like.
Yeah.
He's the one character who has, like, a legitimate, real, emotional goal, which is to confront his father and ask him, why was I born? I mean, granted, he then pushes his father's eyes in when he doesn't like the answer, but still, it's a reasonable thing to want, you know?
Yeah, and the great thing about Blade Runner is it makes you realize that, like, we as humans have the power to create, but we also have the power to, like, destroy things,
mm-hmm.
because they create these replicants, and then the replicants are people. They have like thoughts and feelings,
yeah.
And then we're just kind of like, no, we created you just to like basically help us and do what we created you for our own purpose, not for the fact that we wanted to make the world a better place. We created you just to because we could.
Yep.
And I think that's like very telling, because we still do that kind of shit in today's
exactly.
world.
Yeah, I feel like the movie is actually more interesting on today's politics and what's happening today in the
mm-hmm.
world than maybe it was in the 80s.
Right.
I mean, maybe we should talk about that a little bit. I mean, it took 10 years for the movie to even get a cult following. It didn't do very well. Do you think that it was ahead of its time? People just didn't understand it or weren't ready for it?
I think so. I mean, it was one of the first movies that depicted a future that was not that was neither like post-apocalyptic and like wastelandy, but that was also
pristine
not
and perfect.
Yeah, yeah, it's really it's. I mean, it is not a very pleasant picture of Los Angeles in the 2010s. So I think that that was part of it, and I think just the general weirdness of it that it took a while. And it took a while for people basically my age, people who saw it who were a little too young to really process the sort of the adult emotional stuff about the sex scene, about even about Roy Batty's sort of loss, to like catch up and become people to who can who responded to the style of it, because the style is so gorgeous. And that fusing of 1940s style and Art Deco with flying cars and a sort of noir-y feel took a while for people to, like, get on board with it. I think that part's ahead of its time. I don't know if it's thematically ahead of its time.
Or maybe people just weren't ready to face the truth yet. I mean, yeah. The 80s is a lot about, you know, affluence and, you know...
I'm not a crook.
No, that's the 70s.
I don't know.
That's Nixon.
I don't know. I know it's Nixon. I don't know what year it is.
Reagan was a president in the 80s.
Oh, yeah, that's right. This was our We Want Movie Stars Running Our Country era.
That was when that seemed like a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something
Reagan's trickle-down economics.
Exactly.
Thinking of the 80s, here's something that I thought of when I saw it, because I got to see it on the big screen at the Moving Image, which I've mentioned podcast before. Is this is before I saw Stranger Things, before Stranger Things started, and the big red letters come on the screen, and I just went, oh, so 80s. and I went, oh, where did I, like, it just sort of came into my mind, and I didn't even know where it came from, because it was such a small little memory. Yep. And then Stranger Things comes out, and it's this red lettering. Yep. And it's so interesting, like, even the Ladd Company at the beginning is in red.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it was that they could use it better, but it's sort of interesting how things become trends. This is pretty early in the 80s, you know. I don't know what other movies had used sort of red titles. And then it became a thing.
And then, yeah, it definitely became a thing. I mean, that particular font that they use with the spaces instead of the holes in the, like, in the B and the R and the way that it's sort of all cut up, that is, like, super 80s, super future. That you saw that in on a poster and you're like, oh, that takes place in the future. That's cool.
I also, as a big Back to the Future fan, all of a sudden went, oh, the cars.
Yeah.
I had no clue. Cars. The cars in Back to the Future look just like the cars in Blade Runner.
Well, yeah, because that's... Which chose that. But I was looking up Ridley Scott, and I think the main reason why people maybe didn't like this one as much as they liked Alien was because Alien depicted a gruesome world that wasn't ours.
Mm-hmm.
Blade Runner is our world and shows our gruesome nature and not this other beings coming in. Like, and he does that all the time, and I think with Prometheus, he showed what he was showing with Blade Runner was like, what we create is what will destroy us. Because Michael Fassbender's character, David, I couldn't remember the character name, David ends up like being the bad guy and killing everybody in Prometheus because we created David and we like, we're like, we abused him to the point where he was like, okay, fine. And like killed everybody.
Yeah.
And I think that's like a theme in Ridley Scott's stuff where he's like, oh yeah, these other beings are going to be what kill us, but we are what create them.
Right.
And I think Alien gave him the footing to do it for Blade Runner, but then no one liked Blade Runner because it was too much. Like, oh, well, shit, this could happen. I don't like this.
Well, he considers it his most personal film, so that's really interesting.
Well, because you can clearly see in his other movies that it was, like, his agenda.
I'm not as familiar with a lot. I'm not as familiar with a lot of his other movies. I love Ridley Scott. Not. He seems really like a genius. I think the big issue that he had with Harrison was that he was so concerned as a director with the visuals, which are amazing, that Harrison Ford felt ignored as an actor.
Yeah, and
what we've learned
about it a lot.
Yeah, and what we've learned from the podcast, so I'm not surprised that he complained, is that it seems to us, based on the research and what we've talked about, is that Harrison likes that. He only feels comfortable and only does, I think, a really great job as an actor when he has a director where he can bounce ideas off of, talk about the character, go through the scene. That's when he's the most successful.
Right.
So he was frustrated at this. But what I do think is great and shows how professional they both are is that they still both respect each other as artists. And you can see that with the way they talk about each other.
Yeah.
And today would be like, you know what? We had a hard time. We disagreed. I think we're both over it now. You know, but there was a really great film, but we didn't, you know, didn't really get out of it. Both had wanted, which I think is really, that's really great as a professional to be go, yeah, you know what? Great job. But yeah, we didn't really work well together.
And I think Harrison Ford was also frustrated, like from the few interviews that I've read about him and the one time that he came to my school to talk about it. One of his frustrations also was that like there were so many other voices as well involved in the making of this film. There was a studio. Yeah. That what they were making became so muddied by the end of it and changed so much. I mean, I talk about the voiceover, but the voiceover is a really, really huge point of contention among fans of the film and amongst with Harrison Ford as well, that like the use of the voiceover, where it was used. I remember him talking about coming in and he was so annoyed at having to do the voiceover. And he gave like the crappiest performance the last time that they brought him in to do the last version, and that's the version they used. And he's enraged by that.
Well, he did it twice. He did it once, and they were like, "Were drugs involved?" They made him do it again, and yeah, he did it really badly. So let's talk about some of the other actors in the film, because it's a really amazing cast. Some of them were, you know, sort of stalwarts at the time. And a lot of them, this is one of the first few movies that they were in. Mm-hmm. This is like Rucker Howard's third American film.
Yep.
It's also Sean Young's like second or third film. Daryl Hannah, it's her fourth film.
Is it her fourth film? Wow.
Yeah, I looked it up. I was surprised with that.
I thought it was her first.
And well, this is her first big one. Like, okay. She did like films that I've never heard of before. So she had experience in front of the camera. It's not like she's complete. But yeah, she was 21.
Wow.
Her screen test is really interesting, Daryl Hannah, because did you know this? That they, and I think it was a little more, it was still rare back then, but they still did it more than they ever do it today, which is where they did screen tests that were fully lit, fully costumed in makeup.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And almost like it's, you know, 1944 or something. But I do sort of wonder if, you know, they were doing that a little bit more. It was still rare, whereas now we would never, ever do that. In fact, the actor who played Holden, the interviewer from the beginning, stood in for Harrison Ford, and they liked him so much they invited him to do another part. And she picked out the look.
Interesting.
All that is for the makeup and the hair, and she thought she wasn't going to get it because everyone looks so pretty. She's like, I look like a freak.
That was a great choice. That is like that is such an exciting thing, that look, and it's so new wave, and like was so the, again, setting the model. Like there's so much about everything else that happened in the 80s that comes from the look of those characters and the way that they are, particularly Pris and Roy Batty with that freaking blonde hair. Oh man. Rutger Hauer is so cool. Though, of course, you know, I was a prepubescent boy, so I've always had a crush on Zora and Joanna Cassidy thereafter, because, you know.
Joanna Cassidy's fantastic.
She's naked,
I used to watch,
so yeah.
Do you know, maybe you know this, the film Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
She's Rose, and so I always think of her. She's also on an episode of Heroes, is a very important character.
Oh my
but,
God.
But I always think of her from that. I mean, she was very prominent in the 80s. She was on a lot of. I worked at Blockbuster when I was going through school.
Gee, I'm like looking her up. She has 162 credit.
She's been in a lot of stuff, and I watching the Blu-ray specials, which blew my mind, was that in 2007 she came back. And refilmed her head for the scene when she goes through the glass,
really?
So they could make it actually her.
Wow, that's really cool.
It blew my mind. Usually I'm like, oh, don't do that. But the problem was that you could obviously tell that it was a stunt woman.
Right, yeah.
So for the new version in 2007, they had her sit in this chair. And she had like the face makeup and a little bit of like her chest was done, and they put her in a wig and she like tried to mimic the movements.
And they de-aged her like they did Jeff Bridges for the Tron movie.
I mean, I guess they did. I don't know. I mean, this was 2007. But also, I mean, on this is Harrison Ford's son Ben came in, and they used him because in the scene when he's talking to the snake salesman, it was at a sink.
Oh.
So they they couldn't find the audio or the visuals to be able to make it in sync. So they took Ben, who apparently went to school with one of the people working on it, so he felt comfortable asking him, gave him a scar. You can see that he's like, this is really surreal. Put him in a chair, and they had him like mouth the words of, for his dad. And he was the exact same age as his dad when he did the movie.
Wow.
And it's his. They used his jaw.
That's so cool. That is so very cool. It's weird, but that is
it's
cool.
It's insane, but it was really awesome.
Well, he looks just like him. He's just shorter.
I think he looks just like him,
but his, like, I'm, like, doing the motion of it, but, like, where Harrison Ford can stand straight up, Ben, like, has no neck, so his, like, shoulders like this. And so, like, that's the difference between that.
I really loved Edward James Olmos.
Oh God, Edward James Olmos is so slinky in this movie and like slightly villainous. And I want to follow him. I want them to like do a sequel that's just all about Gaff and what Gaff does all day.
He went to language classes and he made up that language. Most of it's Hungarian, apparently.
No.
But something about him going a little bit back to story that I watched a lot of documentaries was some people believe and I kind of liked it was that the reason he left the unicorn at the end wasn't to say you're a replicant.
Right.
It was to say, go off with her.
Yeah.
Do what you need to do. I know. So he took a memory from her.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like it was sort of interesting that he actually has a lot more control as a character as Gaff than you realize he does. That was really interesting to me.
That's what I've always taken from it. That's what it's about. And it's really about get out of this world where nothing good can happen. You know, it's raining and constantly and miserable and everyone is sort of corrupted from top to bottom. And that's another thing that I love about the replicants is that they have such sort of hope, you know, like they just want to live free. Like it's such a great, place that they come from, that they want to believe in sort of the best of the world, and are just confronted at every turn with the worst. And it's really heartbreaking, ultimately, you know.
I forget who it was, but in one of the documentaries that I was watching, and it may have just been a director who grew up loving the movie, said that it's Deckard's loss that he's not a replicant.
Exactly. Exactly.
Do you have a favorite performance, Rachel, that isn't Harrison in the film?
I really actually kind of like Sean Young.
Oh, you do? Okay, let's talk about that.
I like Sean Young. I like Rachel. I think she looks the coolest. While Daryl Hannah looks cool, I think Rachel's costumes and like the look of Rachel is just so cool.
She looks just like Joan Crawford.
I think she's great. But I was reading quotes from Sean Young when I was looking at her IMDb, and I don't like her. Because it was like every actor was, he was sexist towards you. I'm like, calm down. If it's every actor is sexist towards you, something's wrong with you.
Well, that's why I wanted to make a point that Harrison treated the other women on set had nothing but positive things to say about Sean Young. And I don't want to say anything bad about Sean Young because I don't know her and we don't know the situation.
Right.
But there are a lot of actresses who are branded because of sexism that they have bad behavior, but they're still working.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, you don't want to get into that, like, call this person or that person crazy for being, you know, whoever they are.
This business can make you a little crazy. Exactly. Like, I get it.
Exactly. And, you know.
See, here, I have sort of a little dilemma with my thought on Sean in the movie.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that she's a very good actress in it. That's my opinion. But it is sort of called for in a way because she's robotic and she doesn't have a lot of emotion and is very new. And so it does fit. But Ridley picked her because he liked her look and people really wanted him to pick a more experienced, better actors.
Right. And I feel like that right there sums up, you know, one of the things that is awkward and why they keep coming back to this movie is that it looks so good. But I don't know how much he cared about whether or not it hung together or made real sense or, you know, much like Prometheus. Yeah.
And it must be hard if you're not concerned with the actors and then the other actors who have more experience and are more professional are left alone with an actor that they would consider green, as Harrison did, considered her green, and then there's no one to wrangle. And it is awkward, I know, as actors, I'm sure we know, and in you working with actors, that it's awkward for another actor to direct.
Right.
Another actor. It's not really something that you should do.
No, but there's also that thing about making, you know, film and TV is in many ways, a lot of those scenes are partnerships between the two actors. The two actors yes. figure out what's going on in the scene. And if you're working with someone who may be inexperienced and maybe she can't help. And if your director can't help, I can see being frustrated with the whole process yeah. if, you know, you're working with someone who can't figure out what this scene is about, you know.
And night shoots make you crazy.
Oh, my God. And they must have been wet and cold all the time.
Yeah, they said it was miserable. Yeah. A lot of people say, you know, you look at Harrison Ford, he's great in it. But when he looks miserable, it's because he's miserable.
Well, that's her quote about Harrison Ford was he wasn't happy until they told him it was done. her quote is literally like he was never happy on that set. And the only time he was when they said it was finished filming.
And he's very private, you know, on Temple of Doom. Right. We pre-recorded Temple of Doom, and Kate Capshaw has lovely things to say, but she's like, he's private, didn't really get to know him, but she was okay with that.
Yeah.
Some people maybe are different personalities and are think, oh, it's me, I've done something wrong.
Right, and he was also working with a director who cares a lot more about actors and was probably a lot more capable
exactly,
of like
yeah.
working
his
with
ideal,
him.
That's why people like Spielberg are his ideal director.
Exactly.
Really.
But I also want to call out Bill Sanderson, who is one of my
yes,
favorite
please.
1980s
oh,
characters.
I was so
actors.
Happy to see him. I didn't know he was in it when I went
he's
to go see it.
So he's really good in it, and it's really weird. And then you remember that he's, you know, Daryl
It was Larry.
Larry with his brother Daryl right, yeah. and his other brother Daryl. And like so many other great little quirky parts all through like the 70s and 80s and 90s. And it's just – and this is probably the most different because he usually winds up playing like – weird backwoods rednecks.
It's really interesting character. I feel so bad for him, though.
And Sebastian, yeah, is such an interesting character and so
well,
sort
that's
of.
That's why he's on True Blood too.
Oh, he was. He was on Deadwood as well. Like he's become that actor who probably at the time of Newhart when he was Larry was like very well known and mm-hmm. now is sort of able to disappear into his roles and you don't right. really realize that it's him anymore, which is I think really nice. Whereas Emmett Walsh is the kind of character actor that I know right away.
Oh, God.
Like, Emmett you've been Walsh. A billion things. I know exactly who you are. I
that,
love
that
you.
Face. And amazingly, he's still alive? Sorry, I was just
I know,
up a,
yeah.
How is Emmett Walsh still alive? Holy crap.
He could also look older than we think he is. Some actors,
yes.
yeah.
He's definitely an actor who looked that way, the way he looks in Blade Runner from the time he was 35.
Yes.
Robert Duvall has looked the exact same throughout his entire career. And I'm like, okay, he was 90 in the 70s. How old is he now?
Well, interesting enough is that he and Harrison got along so well. They yeah. loved each other. They said at some point they ended up in a photo booth. That's how close they were.
That's very close.
Which, you know, so shows that he's a private person. But, you know, sometimes he only really, I think, connects with certain people. But, so I think we are now, we're kind of out of time, though, but are there any other things that you'd like to say about Blade Runner that we haven't gotten a chance to cover?
Not really. I mean, one, I've got to see the 2007. It's been a while, actually, since I've seen a new cut. So I'm ready, I think, finally to see a new cut of Blade Runner and learn something new about it. I wish that it was on streaming. Guys, get it on streaming.
It oh, was, no. and then it went away.
So this is what happened. The day that I actually saw it, I forget when it was. Was it May? But was the last day that the rights were available. So they pulled the rights. So the same day that I saw it was the same day that it left Netflix, because, you know, it had been on Netflix for a while.
Yeah.
And they mentioned it at the talk, which is interesting, because they said, you know, we were supposed to have this, we were going to do a whole sort of marathon thing, because Hampton actually came to talk, which is why I went to
oh,
hear
wow.
him speak. We wanted to do this actually tomorrow, but we can't because we wouldn't have the rights to do it. Today is the last day.
Oh, man.
So I have a feeling that they're pulling it because the sequel is starting to film. And they kind of did that with Star Wars for a while where it was – actually, well, it isn't streaming. You have to buy it. But it's still like – it sounds like maybe something – I don't know the logistics. You might know better than I would.
Yeah, those
that they're pulling it because – yeah. I'm guessing it's because of the sequel is being made.
Yeah, and it's got a bunch of weird – we've got to add a bunch of weird production companies involved. So – I'm sure the rights are a mess. The Ladd Company. Like, that's really a thing.
It is, actually. And funny thing that I'm reading. I don't know if they still are, but he does producing stuff. There are a lot of stories in Harrison Ford's stories that I haven't mentioned with Star Wars where they would call him, and he just seems like a really great guy, where he'd be like, you know what, I'm your friend, and I'm going to help you with the extra money that you didn't have. Yeah. Like, he just sounds like kind of a really cool guy when it comes to film and his friends.
That's really cool.
Yeah, but no, I don't know if it still is. He still produces, I believe. But
he's still alive. Alan Ladd Jr. Go figure. Always amazed.
Rachel, yeah, do you
this last... this was only like 1982. It's not like it was like the 50s.
Do you have any last thoughts about Blade Runner that we haven't talked about?
It's pretty.
Yeah, I think... I think it's wonderful, and the more I've been reading about what it really means and what it's about and all the different endings, it's really fascinating, but it's hard to watch. I don't think it's something that I would regularly, you know, watch a lot on a regular basis again.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, it's slow and weird, and it is not a happy movie, so I can see that.
But you see how it had a huge influence on science fiction from then on, and it's an important film.
It is, and it deserves the place that it has.
It does,
yeah. Well, one last time, you want to pitch your stuff?
Yeah,
the podcast, your show.
You want to pitch?
Where I want to pitch. You on social media? You can find me best on the Twitter machines at Jay Holtham, and see Pitch when it premieres on September 22nd. Check out Deep Cut Nerd and Part Time Fanboy, and you'll hear me talk about other things in these same dulcet tones.
And your handle on Twitter for Deep Cut Nerd? Is it Deep Cut Nerd?
Deep Cut Nerd Pod at Deep Cut Nerd Pod.
Here you go. Awesome. Thanks so much for being on. This was great.
Let me on. This is terrific. Thank you,
Rachel.
And that was our interview with Jay Holtham. So any final little tidbits on Blade Runner?
I think we have Blade Runnered it out.
We have. And there is news, but we're going to talk about it when it's not a long episode, but
yeah,
be out there on the internet, guys. Blade Runner news is all around us.
Yeah, we didn't get to talk about Blade Runner 2, and I have some info direct from Budapest, so save that for when we come back, because we pre-record through September, and then we're going to come back with our Comic-Con episode in October.
And maybe, you know what, we'll do a whole episode Comic-Con, and we'll put the Blade Runner stuff in there, because maybe we'll learn some stuff at
That's a good idea.
Comic-Con. I am so smart, guys.
She really is. And we would love you to be smart and go on iTunes. Queen of the segue. You know, sometimes if you don't laugh at it, the audience will laugh and the joke can just lie there.
No, they'll laugh along with me. The cackle is like, cool, we're going to laugh at that.
Let the joke live. Like, let it breathe like a glass of wine.
I like people breaking in scenes.
Okay. So if you could go on iTunes and review and rate us, it would mean so much to us. We don't have a chance to read the reviews that we've gotten, but we're going to read them when we come back.
Yes.
It means so much to us. It lets us know if we're doing a good job, if we can keep doing it, and it brings the show to more people on iTunes. Make a nickname under your profile, rate and review us, would mean so much. Also, we have a contest going on, and since we're pre-recording, instead of announcing the winner today, we're going to leave it till September 22nd, which is the official last day of summer. So the summer contest will be until then. You can listen to the show, then go on our Tumblr, which soon will be our website.
Mm-hmm.
Enter the contest by answering a trivia question on the most recent episode, and the more places you follow us, the more entries that you can get. And also, we have different things. So if you are on Twitter, we are at the Fordcast PC. We have up-to-date news. We have other podcasts that we retweet from. A lot of the podcast community in Star Wars and sci-fi is on there. On Facebook, anyone who is likes us on Facebook gets 5 extra entries in every contest that they enter. Instagram, we do a bi-movie, so we just finished Blade Runner, and then we'll be doing Return of the Jedi, which is our next film. And then any trivia that we don't have time for, because we could talk forever about Harrison Ford, we will put that extra trivia on the Instagram with the pictures. So you should definitely follow us on there. Tumblr, we have news, discussions, theories, great gifts, reblogs, and that right now is our webpage until we will launch right before Comic-Con. You also have some news about a column that you wrote.
Yeah, I started writing for The Culturist, and I'm actually going to be writing a Star Wars article soon when I get that done about Star Wars versus Star Trek and how you can be a fan of both.
Oh, nice.
And up there is my ode to the love of my life, Babs, as well as the other love of my life, Chris Pine, and Harrison will be there. So there's the third love of my life. Just keep them going. And yeah, and then you also have an article.
I do. I have a monthly column on forcesofgeek.com. Right now you can get my three parts. I'm a nerd. Series on the villain Angela Petrelli from the series Heroes, who's one of my top like five favorite females ever in sci-fi and things in general. And I just sort of talked about her philosophy and where she comes from as a villain. So you can check that out. It's on forcesofgeek.com. And every month I'll have a different column that I promise will not be three parts.
All right. And you can follow me on Twitter at Rachel Leishman.
You can follow me on Twitter at Lauren Milberger.
And until next time, bye.
Bye. Hey guys, co-host Lauren here. Rachel and I just wanted to let you know that next Thursday, September 8th, you can listen to us as guests on the Beltway Banthas podcast. Beltway Banthas is a great political Star Wars podcast, and we were invited on to talk about Harrison Ford's activism. The two of us had so much fun with hosts Steven and Terso, so definitely check them out and us at beltwaybanthas.com. They're on Twitter at Beltway Banthas. And you can listen to them just like you listen to us on iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever you listen to podcasts. And then we'll see you the week after with Return of the Jedi. Bye.